Welcome to the Real Clear Politics Takeaway for Friday, November 27th. I'm Andrew Walworth. Well, President-elect Joe Biden has begun the transition process and started naming his team, including some key foreign policy positions for the new administration. So far, these names are pretty familiar, at least to Washington insiders, and they include longtime Biden aide Antony Blinken as Secretary of State and former Senator and Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry for a cabinet-level position dealing with global climate change. What do we know about these folks? What do their nominations tell us about the direction of Biden's foreign policy, especially in his first 100 days? Well, joining me to talk about this are Carl Cannon, Real Clear Politics Washington Bureau Chief, and Jeff Gedman, President of American Purpose, a new media project. He's also Editor-in-Chief of the American Interest and former President of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. So, Jeff, let's take a look at this new team, starting with Antony Blinken. He's the nominee for Secretary of State, 58 years old. He's worked for Biden for 20 years. What do we know about him, and what does it tell us about the direction of Biden's foreign policy?
Well, thank you, Andy. Tony Blinken is accomplished. He's qualified. He speaks French. He knows Europe, other parts of the world. He was Deputy Secretary of State to John Kerry in the Obama administration, as you say, longstanding relationship with Joe Biden. I would say that his friends and fans will say he knows his stuff. And his critics and detractors will say, oh dear, this is the old establishment coming back, a throwback to a period we should have left by now.
Yeah, Carl, this does not sound like the team of rivals so far. It's like getting the old band back together again.
Well, yes, that's a good way of saying it, Andy. And the other thing is that what Joe Biden wants to do is he's boasting about being the establishment. He's saying 4 years of Donald Trump showed us that the swamp, it wasn't really the swamp. It was a beautiful wetlands. And we're going to do trips through it. We're going to give kayaks through it. We're going to show people the wildlife. We're going to cure global warming so this wetlands last in pristine state. He's putting a different face on it. He's saying Washington worked better before. Our international relationships are more important than Donald Trump thought they were. He is unapologetically returning to the status quo we're seeking to.
And Jeff, is that a fair view of the Trump legacy that's being left to him? The idea is that we have to go back because we can't go forward based on what Trump has done.
Well, you know, and as I hear Carl speak, and I appreciate a lot the way, Carl, you described the situation. We're in one of those moments in American politics where a bunch of things can be true at the same time. You know, Washington did work better before. If you go back to the 1990s, a lot pre-Newt Gingrich, when Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill would get together at the end of the day, it was tough, it was partisan, it was competitive, but there was a different moment and a different kind of functionality. So I'm tongue-in-cheek. Yeah, you have to go back 30 or 35 or 37 years. What we inherit now has been long in coming. And to cut to the chase, I think if President-elect Biden and his team don't understand what has changed in the American electorate, actually a lot, on right and left, and it predates Donald Trump, and in international relations and order, and actually a fair amount, and that too predates Donald Trump, they will miss the boat and I think get us into a boatload of trouble.
What are the risks if we pretend it's just business as usual? If we turn the clock back four or five years, Jeff, and say, look, it was better then. Let's go back to that. What has changed that this is a pitfall?
So here are a couple of thoughts, Carl, and then I'm eager to hear you. So one thought is voter ties to mainstream parties, including in our country, have been loosening for years, long before Donald Trump arrived. And that's why in 2016 in primaries, the big winners at that moment as a snapshot were Bernie on the left and Trump on the right. And what did they have in common? They were both the anti-establishment candidates. They were running against Washington and Wall Street in their own ways. That hasn't gone away. And foreign policy in a democracy depends on the electorate and support. And so the Biden folks can't say, well, more than 70 million people voted for Trump, but they're just lunatics and fascists. That ain't so. And Biden has a problem on his left, too. The second thing, Carl, the world has been watching us for two decades now. So let me give it in shorthand and let me exaggerate for effect. And you please pick through it. If you are 38 or 40 or 42 years old and you're in Berlin or Tokyo, or if you're in Taiwan or Brazil and you're in a foreign ministry or an editorial board or industry, the America that you mostly know, think about it. During your professional lifetime for the last 20 years, shorthand, ready? Exaggeration for effect, but there's something to what I'm saying. You know America of Iraq and Afghanistan? Wow. Imperial unilateralism, overreach, and not a good outcome. You know America of the 2008 financial global crisis that was seen in any case as mostly made in America. You see Obama, two terms, eloquent, effective though, question mark, and then you have reality television show real estate mogul Donald Trump. I think allies and adversaries take stock of a different America after the last 15 to 20 years than they do of the America closing the Cold War in the 80s and having that glorious run, so to speak, in the 1990s. Things structurally, culturally have changed at home and abroad, I believe.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. But those 70-some million who voted for Donald Trump, it's probably going to end up being, you know, closer to 73 million. But Joe Biden's going to be close to 80 million who voted for him. Among those Americans who voted for Joe Biden, I think this word globalist is not a dirty word. I grant you what you were saying about the 2016 election. Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump said very similar things about NAFTA. You could put quotes in one guy's mouth or the other, and you could win a bar bet. And other things, foreign wars, foreign engagement. This is true. And a politician who ignores that does so at his own peril. On the other hand, you have a generation of Americans coming up. They're more secular than any group of Americans going back to the founding. And their catechism is global warming. They call this an existential threat. Donald Trump appealed to a different group of Americans. He said that this Paris Accord is a joke. It ignores China and India. It ignores the world's biggest polluters. It's really an income redistribution thing and a bunch of crap in Europe, meetings that amount to nothing, and we're pulling out of it. And the sky did not fall. His supporters looked at that and thought he was right. But the people voted for Joe Biden said, you know what? It sent a bad signal to the world, and we want to re-engage on that. And so John Kerry can be our guy. Now, there's two ways to look at that. One, if you give John Kerry a problem that can't be solved, maybe you're just getting him out of your hair. But the other thing is it shows America is willing to re-engage with the world again on these issues and the issues that young people find important. And multinationalism to them is not only not a bad idea, they think it's essential.
Jeff, I'm glad Carl brought up multilateralism because it is really emerging as a theme of the Biden transition. For example, Biden's nominee for the U.S. ambassador to the UN is Linda Thomas Greenfield. She's one of the most high-profile African-American diplomats. She's very experienced. And she said, quote, multilateralism is back. And I think the pushback on that is that multilateralism is an approach, not a policy objective. That is, it's a way to get something done, not the thing itself. But Carl is suggesting that at least to some people, it is important to work together with allies for its own sake. And that has been criticized by some as, quote, leading from behind. So this sounds like it could be a real shift in U.S. policy, is it?
Well, it may well be, Andy. There's always been this divide roughly between conservatives and liberals in the United States on multilateralism, where the conservatives tend to say, sure, when it suits, where it's useful as a means. And there's always the suspicion among liberals and Democrats that it's both means and ends. You know, it just feels good to be together with others jointly and jointness. Now, I'm being a little bit mean, but there you are. If you step back for a moment, I think if you look around the globe and look around what, you know, multilateralism actually means, there's something structural to this. If you're a big power, generally speaking, you're not fond of multilateralism because it hems you in and slows you down. If you're a smaller or medium-sized power, you love it look at Germany or the EU nations, because it leverages you up and it does slow down the hegemon who either you want to keep up with or you want to check a little bit. So that's that point. I think that if I may, Andy, I want to go back, if I may, to something Carl said, and it's an underlying theme among, well, for a lot of these conversations. We are a divided country at this moment. We are a polarized society at this moment. To have any kind of coherent foreign policy, you have to have some basis or foundation that runs across America. You can't have pockets and segments and tribalism left and right. I think that the trick is maybe we're at this point where we have to remember that this country has always been hard to keep together. It's always been fractious and fragmented and representing so many things to so many people. We had a civil war. We're not thinking a civil war is coming, but maybe we're at a moment, Carl and Andy, and maybe foreign policy will reveal it in sharpest relief during the Biden administration of how divided we are and how demanding it is to keep us somehow coherent. And I just finished that riff by saying, you know, let's see if Biden can glue some parts of us back together. But, you know, to my friends on the Biden side, this could be a very short period of Democratic rule. We may be thinking about the Tucker Carlson administration sooner than you think.
Well, let's just talk about the world that Trump has left Joe Biden, Jeff. Just take the Abraham Accords as a starting place. Moving the embassy, getting these accords signed, a lot of this was not supported by people on the left. It seems to be working pretty well. I think it might go down as a real step towards peace in the Middle East. What do you make of that? And what is Biden going to do with it?
So I hope that Biden, I was not a supporter of Donald Trump. And I hope that Joe Biden doesn't conclude everything Trump did, we have to do the opposite. I hope there's a more deliberative process and careful calculation of what's working and what's not working. And this seems to have worked, as you said. I don't know what Biden is going to do. We know he's fond of the Paris Accords. He's fond of the Iran deal. We have indications of a number of instances where he will move in a different direction. Let me answer your question, Andy, in a different way. If we want to represent and advance our interests and values in the world, we're going to need coalitions and allies, tactical or strategic. We can't do it all the time, all by ourselves. That's a historical fact. What we ought to learn as Americans, and I'm not trying to pander to allies or foreign powers, but think outside looking in how you could get whiplash if you're an American ally, regardless of what your preferences are. One administration wants to move the embassy to Jerusalem. The other detests that and wants to reverse it. One is all in on the Iran deal. One is all out. Then we're back in, but maybe we're out again in 4 years. Ditto Paris Accords. Ditto approach to North Korea. Ditto approach to China. Remember during the Obama days, Bush 43, we're all in on ballistic missile defense. Thank you, Central Europeans. Obama arrives and says, nope. Done, out, finished. These allies and countries count on us. They have to calculate. They have their own domestic constituencies. So I'm changing my answer to your question a little bit to say, I don't know what the Biden administration is going to do. I would urge them to be thoughtful, deliberative, and careful. Not everything that transpired on the Trump administration was to be loathed. But if they want to do multilateralism and create better alliances, they better think about America as a dependable, predictable power and not as a political football in Washington for partisanship and jockeying.
Carl.
I couldn't agree with that more. The level of partisanship we have now has spilled over into foreign policy. If you look at public opinion polls of Americans' views of Vietnam, very controversial war, Korean War, even World War II, you didn't get partisan differences. You had sizable groups of Americans who were opposed to Korea and Vietnam, but it didn't break strictly along partisan reasons. And it shouldn't have, because those are not actually partisan questions on what the Democratic and Republican parties view. But you look at the Gulf War, and especially George W. Bush, the war in Iraq, the second war in Iraq, strictly partisan, like other issues, like abortion, you know. And that is not healthy for our country for the reasons Jeff said. It suggests to our allies that our foreign policy will veer wildly depending on the election. And we have elections every 4 years, and some of these policies can't be changed every 4 years. Yeah, are we going to change the embassy in Israel every 4 years? I mean, right, doesn't make sense. Now, you know me, it's the day after Thanksgiving, it's the holiday season. I'm a pretty optimistic guy anyway. So let me just say, I think Joe Biden understands this. I don't know about all his aides, but Biden's been in Washington long enough. He's not a Democrat who gets allergic when he has to talk to Republicans. He just doesn't. He actually relishes making deals and forging consensus. You know, he might be the right guy for the time on these issues we're talking about now. And I'll give you an example we haven't talked about so far. If Donald Trump hadn't been president, and let's just stipulate for a moment, the media took sides during the last 5 years, and the establishment media was not the Trump side. And when this virus hit the world, and there was a guy at the CDC reading a report on December 31st, the last day of 2019, and there was a report from China about this new respiratory illness. From that moment, China didn't let the CDC go in right away to get samples. By then, it had sent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of travelers from the Wuhan province to Europe, to Seattle, to LA, to San Francisco, all around the world, while you couldn't travel from Wuhan to Beijing. The WHO was slow to call this a pandemic. It resisted quick action. These are questions we would have asked of China, but the media and the Democrats decided we don't want to ask those questions of China. We want to ask them of Trump. We had a partisan response in this country and in the media to the pandemic. But this is not something that Joe Biden is stuck with. Joe Biden can ask tough questions. If the World Health Organization has become unduly influenced by Beijing, Joe Biden can call them out on that. If Beijing owes an explanation to the world why it allowed people to travel to Britain and the west coast of California and Italy, but not Beijing, he can ask them, and he can make that in a public forum. So just as we're not wed to the policies of Trump, we're also not wed to this hyper-partisanship either. Biden doesn't need to engage in it, and he keeps signaling that he doesn't want to engage in it. So to me, he has a lot of freedom to pursue the policies he likes, irrespective of whether Trump pursued them or not. And this is what Jeff was getting to. Biden isn't bound by everything Trump did, but he's not bound to oppose everything Trump did either.
I saw a meme the other day. It said, friends don't tell friends that 1980 was 40 years ago, which is kind of a frightening thought. But, you know, I will admit I'm old enough to remember those days. And I don't remember the kumbaya days of foreign policy. I remember fighting about the nuclear freeze, and I remember fighting about INF deployment in Europe. I remember fighting about aiding the Contras. I remember a lot of partisanship in foreign policy back then. Jeff, what makes today's moment more divisive? How is it different?
So Andy, let me respond with two thoughts to that. Your first point, is very well taken. I mean, good heavens, Sandinistas and aid to Central America, and you know some of these things. These were often contentious times, and partisanship is part of democracy. We don't have a one-party state. You have different ideas in and out of government and NGOs and parts of parties vying and fighting. That's all healthy and vibrant. I think two things have changed. The first I can't prove to you, and the second I'm going to venture you're just going to agree without quarrel. The first is, and it's back to some of the things Carl was saying, on a broad strategic level having to do with America's role and responsibility in the world and the utility of alliances, I think there was broad bipartisan consensus. And then we fought a lot about tactics and timing. We agreed, not the far left, but we agreed that Soviet communism was a problem. And we agreed that containing it or countering it was the right thing to do. And then we fought over priorities, resource allocations, and tactics around the world. Today, I think even at a broad strategic level, I think these things have been eroding. Maybe they're even breaking down. Another thing, though, that is different, of course, is the nature of the discourse. I think the democratization of media, social media, have changed a lot of the points of orientation, tenor, and tone. As they say, the good news is everybody has a voice, and the bad news is everybody has a voice. And then I'm going to pick up on something, Carl, you alluded to, and this is a problem that doesn't go away even if Biden performs magnificently. It's a piece of a puzzle, but it's very important. How we Americans get our news and information with which we make decisions and vote. And a lot of mainstream outlets like CNN, The Washington Post, The New York Times, Carl said, I think you said, I don't want to put words in your mouth, these were pretty uniformly hostile to Donald Trump. You know, when I open up, still today, the front page of any of those outlets, I see less and less news. I see more and more editorial and advocacy. I don't know if they even function as news organizations anymore as much as they function as advocacy groups or outlets for editorializing. Why do I go there? How do you have any kind of sensible, responsible conversation about these things at the elite level or the electorate level if we don't have a functioning news media with fact-based news and information? And for a variety of reasons, that seems to be being swept away in recent years. I think that affects the foreign policy debate.
Carl? Well, you're nodding your head. Our viewer, our listeners can't see it, but you're nodding your head.
Well, you know that line in Princess Bride, let's call the brute squad. He says, I am the brute squad. Andre the Giant says, I am the media. I born and raised in the press corps. My father worked for 25 years at the Washington Post, covered Reagan. It's all I've ever done. And I don't recognize the press that I joined right out of college at 21 years of age. It's a vexing problem, and I think it hurts foreign policy. It hurts all aspects of American life. But in terms of what can happen, you know, in the coming year, a baseline of facts is important. And Joe Biden may have to set the tone, but you can present facts to people and say, okay, but look, here's what one side believes, here's what the other side believes, here's what I believe. Bill Clinton used to have that discursive style of leadership. He would frequently use straw men for the argument he didn't agree with, but at least it was a way of communicating that conveyed to Americans that people of goodwill could have different views. And the foreign policy issue that I think of, the last time I think of Washington working, was the fight over NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement. I covered that for many years. It was an idea that originated with Ronald Reagan, as sort of a North American accord. He saw Canadians and Mexicans and Americans as kind of one people, counterweight to the European Union economically, yes, but more than that, as sort of a political idea and a cultural idea. It was forged into a treaty by George H.W. Bush, who succeeded him, and presented by Bill Clinton to the Congress and fought for by Clinton. And you had pro-labor Democrats weren't in favor of it. The free marketeers in the House, Republicans under Gingrich were in favor of it. And Clinton had to decide. And he decided globalization is here, whether we like it or not. And this is a treaty that will help Americans compete in the world and help Americans economically, as well as Canadians and Mexico. It would help the border. In those days, you didn't have to apologize for wanting to help Mexico. That was a positive argument. And what he did was he enlisted Gerry Ford and Jimmy Carter in his aides, former Reagan aides. They came to the White House, these Republican the president, think of how extraordinary this was. The president that Bill Clinton defeated, George H.W. Bush, came to the East Room and spoke in favor of this treaty. And after Clinton spoke, he actually said something interesting. He said, well, you see why I lost to this guy. You see how eloquent he is. You know, maybe this was the last day Washington worked and Gerry Ford did it. Jimmy Carter did something on behalf of that treaty and for Bill Clinton he wouldn't even do for himself, which is he called up congressmen and he buttonholed them and he lobbied them. He practiced politics in a healthy way. But the arguments were not ad hominem. The left said this will hurt labor and this it will cost jobs. It led to Ross Perot emerging as a political figure in this country. He said that giant sucking sound you hear is jobs leaving America. And guess what happened? NAFTA worked exactly the way its proponents thought it would work and the way its opponents thought it would work. And what should have happened sometime before Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump went around trashing it is Congress should have gotten together and said, okay, we need to fix NAFTA. There is a problem here. Ross Perot wasn't entirely wrong. There are incentives not in the treaty of NAFTA, but in American law, in American tax law and American labor law that make it too easy for profitable companies to move out of America and into Mexico. We need to fix that. Those conversations never took place. Between the passage of NAFTA in the mid-90s and Trump and Bernie's emergence in 2016, Congress had ceased being able to tackle important issues in a bipartisan way. And I think that's what we need to move back to. So that's my homily.
Carl and Andy, if I may ask both of you, and off your homily, Carl, is it not possible, does our political discourse not allow for dilemmas? Because I think if you looked it up in the dictionary right now, dilemma would be something like a situation which requires a choice between equally difficult or unfavorable outcomes. It's a dilemma. So why do we not have the space for an elected official to stand up and say, if we take stock of free trade and NAFTA specifically, I'm here to tell you it was neither smashing success nor abysmal failure. It did work and did have some positive result. The benefits were not shared equally. There are parts of our society, our fellow Americans, that needed to and need to be protected in transition. It's a little bit complicated, but we're not going to end globalization and free trade. Can I just tell you, it's not in the cards. It's kind of like China and decoupling. Hard decoupling. We're out. You know, we don't play anymore. We take all our toys and go home. That's not happening, okay? And we also know with China and relations, the old status quo can't stick because it didn't yield the results we thought it yielded. It's problematic. But why is there no political discourse without turning American politics into a think tank seminar? I realize that's not where people live and breathe in the country, telling them that we've got to find a way that is sometimes between two opposite poles. I'll add one more. Carl, you talked about climate change, and it is a big issue on the Democratic side and among younger voters and Gen X and millennials, and it's real. Why can't we say, you know, we actually care about the environment? We suspect that climate change is some sort of an issue. And now the hard part is, how do we prioritize, allocate resources, and tend to unintended consequences, including to the American economy? That's the hard conversation, not whether we care about the environment or not. But it seems to me, if it was always a problem, the space is closing, 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 so that we say, Andy, Carl, 45 seconds, are you for or against confronting China over its evil? There you go. And we have a split screen with eight talking heads.
Well, I do think that television is a terrible place to debate foreign policy or debate almost anything these days. So I agree with you on that.
But half an hour podcasts are perfect.
More people should listen to podcasts, I think.
Andy, can I say one thing, though, to what Josh said? I think that was a nice summation of the problem. As far as the solution, I remember when Hillary Clinton first started running for president, she wrote a book called It Takes a Village. To paraphrase, or to maybe use Hillary Clinton's words, she never got to be president. But the sentiment is right. And I would suggest that in terms of changing the discourse in this country to one that's more productive and more oriented towards problem solving, I would say it takes a president.
Well, I agree with that. I think that presidential leadership is important here. But I think there is something more structural at work. And I think that it's harder to solve. And when I look back at an era where we had a sense of national purpose, and I think that that's probably a good prism through which to look at this. I mean, what's lacking right now, it seems to me, is this idea of national purpose. What is America about? What is it for? At a fundamental level, I think that we don't have an answer to that question anymore. The question used to be that we stood for freedom, we stood for democracy, and we stood against oppression overseas particularly communism. There wasn't a lot of debate, at least between the 40-yard lines, if you will, about what America's purpose was. And I feel like today that is what's missing. I don't know how you restore it. I don't know if it can be restored because I don't know if the world will present us with a challenge like that. You would think that the pandemic might have been that challenge. It doesn't seem to have been. Jeff, when you think about American purpose, what is it? How do you define it? And how do we communicate that to the American people in a way that they could understand it and get behind it?
So Andy, I think you, I don't know how long the three of us have been talking, but you kind of nailed it there. You know, the 1980s, Ronald Reagan didn't discover it or invent it, but he crystallized it. And it was limited government, free enterprise, liberty, and anti-communism. And Soviet communism helped us focus our minds abroad. And at that moment, Democrats actually didn't disagree with those fundamental principles. They disagreed about how far and how much and resource allocations. But fundamentally, strategically, morally, there wasn't, I think, a big, profound disagreement with how Ronald Reagan articulated that. And now today, I'll ask the question, Andy and Carl, is it the moment where ideology, technology, and fragmentation marry up in an exceptionally unhelpful and dangerous sort of way, where I have friends in Brentwood who I dare say honestly feel far, far more in common with people in Paris or London than they do in Georgia or South Carolina or Alabama or Mississippi. I would even say that there's some mutual disdain between groups, deepest distrust between groups now in the United States. So how do we get that back? I don't know. Let's hope it doesn't take a foreign enemy or a major war. One would have thought that COVID could have been a rallying point. I'll ask you both the question. Carl says it takes a village, but it takes a president, it takes leadership. If we had had a different president and Donald Trump hadn't been narcissistically whacking away, 24/7, could that have been a moment to bring some of us, not all of us, but some of us a wee bit together? I don't know how we get back, but Andy, I think you're right. Something has been eroding. The cohesion that we had, however imperfect, however flawed, it was always imperfect, it was always flawed, it's been coming unglued. Is the last 10, or is it the last 20, or is it the last 28 years? But it has been coming unglued.
Carl, we're just about out of time here, so I'm going to, as I occasionally do, give you the last word here.
Well, I agree with what both of you said about this, but it's not a, my old friend Bruce Babbitt used to say, it's not an equilibrium position. We have to get it back. As Abraham Lincoln said, we must not be enemies, but friends. And, if Donald Trump had brought Ron Klain into his coronavirus task force back in March and said publicly to the world, to Americans, listen, either Joe Biden or I are the next president. Either one of us has to be up to speed on this. This is beyond partisanship. There was no reason he couldn't have done that. It would have been effective politically, and it would have been effective as a policy. So when you have a president-elect saying, I will represent the people who didn't vote for me just as much as the people who did, which is what Joe Biden said consistently, I submit to you that's a pretty good start. It's a nice way to start the new year.
Well, on that point, we're gonna leave it. I want to thank Carl Cannon and Jeff Gedman for being with me today here on the Real Clear Politics Takeaway podcast. If you want to find out more, check out www.realclearpolitics.com. And we'll be here again next week talking more about the new administration, the first 100 days, the transition, all those sorts of good things. So come back, tell your friends about it. And thank you for listening. For Real Clear Politics, I'm Andrew Walworth.